John Donvan. This is The Connection. You throw a dart at the map of the world these days, and chances are pretty good that you'll land on or near some sort of hotspot, a corner of the globe where anything from civil unrest to all-out attacks on U.S. allies could take us to war. But today we're going to look at a kind of intellectual war that is being fought inside the Pentagon itself, where some are talking of revolution and others just feel on the defensive. There is a theory gaining ground called the Revolution in Military Affairs that imagines a new kind of war without aircraft carriers and tanks and masses of troops, but maybe with weapons in space and battle by computer viruses. But letting go of the past strategies and much-trusted weapons, is always hard for old soldiers before they fade away. Most agree that some change is good and necessary, but so far the only consensus is that any amount of change will be very messy and very expensive. Connection listeners, does waging war in a new millennium mean shrugging off old strategies? And could doing so come at the expense of military preparedness? We are imagining the new face of war this hour, and we would like you to join the conversation. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I am joined now by Thomas Ricks, who is the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The Washington Post, Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution, and Stephen Rosen, Director of the Olin Institute for Strategic Studies at Harvard. Thomas Ricks in Washington, D.C., you are a journalist, but a special kind in the sense that most or many reporters who report on the Pentagon churn out endless copy on budget issues as the budget up, the budget down. But for the last several months, you have really made your mark reporting on a different, more subtle, perhaps, let's say, more stealth story than the usual budget stuff. It's dare we say, about something quite revolutionary?
I'm not sure it's revolutionary. It certainly is about change. It's about the change that Secretary Rumsfeld and the new administration is trying to bring to the U.S. military and the very hard questions that the U.S. military is asking in response.
And what are the hard questions? What's the crux of the discussion happening right now?
It's a little bit murky. It's like listening to a family fight next door. But as best I can make it out, Rumsfeld has come in with a series of new emphases or priorities, not really classically what people have talked about as the revolution in military affairs, but a somewhat different take on it. Rumsfeld's view is that conventional U.S. forces are so good, as we saw in the Gulf War, that we're not likely to see any front-on direct attack on the U.S. military.
Because no one would dare?
Is that
the thought?
Mm-hmm. Because they've seen that it's a recipe for being Saddam Hussein. Any potential adversary would not want to do it. So he thinks the attacks will come in unconventional, what they call asymmetrical ways, that the wave of the future is more likely something like a computer attack or the USS Cole or some variant thereof. And so he wants to emphasize intelligence, missile defense, and operations in space, especially sensors, things that satellites that can do anything from watch activities on the ground to intercepting communications. The U.S. military fears that because there's a tight budget, because of the tax cut, that this is going to have to be funded out of their own conventional weaponry, which is, say, troops, tanks, aircrafts, and ships.
Now, you drew a distinction just now between Rumsfeld's program, or at least, let's say, investigation and review, and this notion of a revolution in military affairs. What is the revolution, the RMA acronym, about?
It really grew out of Soviet thought as they watched American technology advance and realized that the Americans were coming up with a radically new way of warfare. Defense Secretary William Perry a few years ago argued that we were midway or even at the end of a revolution in military affairs. So there's different takes on this, but basically it says that information technology is revolutionizing warfare. And I think that is true.
That was a Soviet perception of U.S.
The originally, uh-huh. as I understand it. What you saw, even more than the Gulf War, was in the Kosovo War. I remember an Air Force targeter telling me in Belgrade, he said, "Tom, we're not just targeting individual buildings. We're targeting individual windows in buildings." The Hotel Yugoslavia, he said, I believe it was, "We are allowed to hit the third floor and the seventh floor, but not the fourth or the fifth." Mm-hmm. And they were putting JDAM bombs through windows to hit specific militia groups that were particularly guilty of war crimes in their view.
Stephen Rosen, picking up on what Thomas Ricks was just talking about, that particular example and other examples of things that are now being tested, are we already in the middle of this revolution?
In my view, no. I think we're its early days.
How far could it go?
Quite far. And if the developments in warfare proceed along the ways in which people who advance the revolution in military affairs think, we might see a change in warfare which is as big as the change from pre-industrial warfare to industrial warfare, mm-hmm. or even the change from chivalric warfare, knights on armor, to mass armies.
All right. This is fascinating. Let's say the revolution happens. Let's say it takes 20 to 30 years. We're at the middle of the century. As you envision the new form of warfare that the Americans will fight, what is that? What does that look like?
Well, as Tom Ricks did say, it's in a form of warfare which is more influenced by control and management of information than it is about mass and firepower. But using that information properly to its best effect may mean a huge cultural change in the military. We're beginning to see little bits of this. But, for example, in the American military now, the people who are best at information processing are not always the senior officers. They're not even the colonels. They're often kind of enlisted people who know how to do this. If you want to use information quickly and properly, you have to delegate authority way down deep into the troops. You can't wait for some high-level officer to figure out what's going on and then give orders. You have to allow the people who are conducting the war to have all the information, which is normally not given to them because it's classified or hard to distribute, and let them make decisions. When I talk to Army officers who are busy trying to think about whether or not they should replace tanks with armored cars, I say to them, the argument's not about whether you should have tank treads or rubber tires. The argument is about whether or not you should give up your view of the relationship between enlisted people and officers.
Which is radical.
Which is harder to do than introducing new technology. New gadgets are something that the military is easy with. This is something that they routinely incorporate. Changing the patterns of behavior, which are the result of decades of training and experience, that's the hard part. It's like asking General Motors to change the way it did business in the 1970s and 1980s. General Motors bought lots of robots, but they used robots in the old way that General Motors used to build cars, and as a result, they wound up being the same creaky old General Motors with robots.
Michael O'Hanlon, in what way does the military go about changing its culture and actually more specifically imagining its future? Have there been other examples where essentially a think tank approach was taken toward looking to the future and trying things out, playing things through, and coming up with a whole new concept?
Yes, John, there have. But in a sense, we've already done some of what Steve has mentioned. He's certainly right to call for more of that. But we have an extremely important non-commissioned officer corps. We give a lot more responsibility to people lower in the ranks, and that's part of why our military's done so well in recent decades. And for me, that sort of suggests a broader theme, which is we don't necessarily need to declare that a revolution is beginning and introduce discontinuous and radical new concepts immediately into our military and throw old things away. We can view this largely as an evolutionary thing because we've really institutionalized the process of innovation in the modern American military. You know, in the old days, people didn't really change their military until they saw an absolute need. We have an enormously large research and development budget. We bring new technology into the force all the time. And I guess the reason I'm somewhat skeptical of some of the arguments made by proponents of this so-called revolution in military affairs is I'm not sure we need to accelerate the pace of innovation that much more. I think we need to at a certain level, and we can afford to because we have no major competitor right now. But I think we have to also recognize that some of these changes have been going on, and we may just need to keep building on them as opposed to accelerating.
Michael, I understand.
If I could jump in here.
Yeah, go ahead, Thomas.
This is Tom Ricks. One thing that strikes me is I think O'Hanlon and Rosen are both making interesting points here. One thing I'm seeing is email. Email is out there. It is in the military right now, but the military has not really focused on the effect it's having on the chain of command, on hierarchy, and the flow of information. I think the generals are really wrapped around the axle on this. It's one reason you're seeing a lot of questions about morale and personnel issues, is that people in the military communicate far differently and far more rapidly than they did 10 years ago.
The officers
and
are...
the military has not really taken that on yet.
Stephen Rosen.
Tom is absolutely right. Admiral Zabrowski, who was tagged to be the new czar of transformation in the Pentagon, likes to tell a story about when the American fleet deployed in the 1996 Taiwan Straits crisis. The standard hierarchical communication system of the United States Navy sent only four messages. everybody else was emailing everybody else. The enlisted people and the lower people are comfortable with this. It's something which a hierarchical culture feels uneasy with. We should be telling people what to do. They should be listening to us. They shouldn't be cross-talking with each other as much. Michael Hamlin is right. We have a large R&D budget. It produces large numbers of very useful weapons. But as I said, technology is one thing. Changing culture is quite different. And to put a point on it, think about the Air Force. The Air Force is run by pilots. The Air Force is run by combat pilots. It is a warrior culture, and the pilots are the warriors.
And the heroes.
And the heroes, quite properly so because of the roles that they played. What if the new technology makes possible an Air Force which is not dominated by manned combat aircraft? What if it makes possible the use of unmanned combat air vehicles?
So you're talking about a military force without heroes.
We're talking about a military force in which the people who currently earned their spurs and rose to power and who believe that they really deserve to be there, quite properly so, they're no longer going to be the dominant figures.
These are the people who put their lives on the line by flying into fire.
Absolutely.
And now you're talking about an Air Force where perhaps, I'm assuming you're saying perhaps there would be unmanned aircraft controlled by remote control.
Even an incremental shift to that kind of warfare is going to be hard for people to accept.
You can see why, though. You can see
Absolutely.
Why an Air Force would say, well, that's what we do. We're about leather and the seat of our pants and flying into it. And you can see why that culture wouldn't want to make that change to America.
All organizations have that problem. I'm a professor. I make my living by standing up in front of students and talking. If you say to me, Professor Rosen, we don't need to do that anymore. We can put all these kinds of things online and replace people like you. I'm not going to be terribly receptive to that.
Michael, I want to talk about a period between the two world wars in the 20th century, relative peace as we're having now. And yet I understand that a tremendous shift did take place in the military, that they discovered and invented amphibious landings between the war and practiced them. They discovered how to use and design aircraft carriers. They discovered how to design and use tank formations. How did that happen in a time of peace? How did that change in culture take place? And are there any lessons learned from that period that could be applied now?
Well, I'm reluctant to answer this with Steve Rosen on the team.
Do you want
here
to let Steve take that?
Well, I'll start and let him back or correct me. But Steve wrote a fantastic book on this very issue about that period of time. And I think to back up a point he just made, one thing that's clear from his analysis of that period is you did need military officers who were prepared to think differently. And you needed to empower parts of the officer corps that had not necessarily had that influence previously. And I accept very much that point he's been making today. I think it's important to recognize, and
okay.
as you were just saying yourself, we have to get other people involved in these decisions, not, for example, just fighter pilots in the Air Force.
All right. So you're establishing what the climate was, but how did they actually do it, Stephen?
Well, they did it in several ways. First, they understand that this kind of change will take time. Because of the kinds of factors we've just been discussing, it's very rare for a senior general to say, everything I've done in my life, everything that gives me my position in the organization, that's all wrong. What you need to do is think about how you begin training the next generation of officers, exposing them to the kinds of things which will prepare them for the future, and then protecting their careers so that they can rise up, so that the time it takes to effect this transformation, historically, is the time it takes for a lieutenant to become a general.
Connection listeners, we're discussing imagining the face of the next war. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And you're listening to The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University, this is...
I'm John Donvan. This is The Connection. There is a battle being fought inside the Pentagon, and it's about war, the nature of armed conflict 10, 20, 50 years from now, and how the U.S. military needs to change to win that war. My guests this hour are Tom Ricks from The Washington Post, Stephen Rosen from Harvard, and Michael O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institution. Stephen, who or what is the font of most of this thinking about a new future inside the Pentagon now?
Most people give credit to a man named Andrew Marshall, who is the director of net assessment at the Pentagon, who is in charge of doing the long-term strategic analysis for the Secretary of Defense. He's the man to whom Tom Ricks referred to as having noticed that the Soviets were noticing us when we were developing something that the Army and Air Force were calling air-land battle, which was a way of using new sensors, new communication technologies, and new precision-guided weapons to generate military power with non-nuclear means that previously you had only been able to develop with nuclear means. When the Soviets saw us being able to do that, they called that a revolution because now you were doing something that required nuclear weapons but without them.
Tom Ricks, Andrew Marshall has been in the Pentagon for half a century, something like that.
About, yeah.
Why have we really never heard of him before this?
He is very stealthy. In many ways, he is like the Revolution of Military Affairs itself. He keeps a very low profile. He doesn't publish a lot, and he limits the release of information from his office. But he's been enormously influential, especially right now, in reshaping the view of how the U.S. military needs to change to meet the new threats of the 21st century.
Has he always been listened to?
No. As I understand it, Les Aspin, when he was defense secretary, never actually spoke to Mr. Marshall. And the last defense secretary, William Cohen, tried to move Mr. Marshall out of the Pentagon and send him into internal exile across the river to the National Defense University.
And why is that? What was he saying that was so, quote-unquote, politically incorrect to the last administration?
There was an enormous amount of skepticism in the military, there was then and is now, about the entire notion of a revolution in military affairs. And I think that Secretary Cohen was influenced especially by the Marines in their view. The Marines are the loyal opposition in this case. They hate the idea of a revolution in military affairs. The Army has some problems with it. The Marines flat out hate it.
Why is that?
The Marine view would be, okay, take the city of Boston. Are you going to patrol it? Are the police going to police it from 15,000 feet? Mm-hmm. And are they going to be effective? No. The Marine view is very much that we're going into an era of small wars, of Somalias and Bosnias, that's the wave of the future. And that a lot of fancy sensors and precise technologies don't get you very far. What they do is inadvertently get you into a nasty street fight with a Somali mob that cleans your clock. And so what they're saying is, let's talk about boots on the ground. Let's talk about these small, messy urban fights, not about long-range precision technologies, because they think that's what's coming down the pike.
All right, Connection listeners, the number to call is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Shalom, hello, you're on the Connection.
Hello. I wanted to ask you to, in line with the saying, devil's in the details, to focus on the specific case, prospective case, and how could the current or the future system cope with it. From various data you're probably familiar with, we know that Saddam Hussein of Iraq is in the process or very close to producing nuclear weapons and developing missile guidance systems more and more accurate and far-reaching.
So you're asking how now, as opposed...
No, I didn't finish my question.
I'm sorry.
If in 2 years, let's say, yeah, mm-hmm. before our anti-nuclear thing is developed, is ever developed, he says, I have 5 missiles direct or through submarines, focus on Boston, Washington, New York, and for good measure, let's say Houston, Texas, where Bush's relatives live, and friends. And unless you remove yourself from the Middle East completely, I'll start taking your cities out, one at a time, all at the same. And as you may know, Saddam Hussein sees himself as a Saladin.
Shalom, I need you to get to the point of your question.
The point is, what at the present time, or in your prospective idea, is the scenario, how would you cope with
it? Okay, Michael Hanlon, I think what he's saying is, how would we deal with it today with what we have, and how would it be dealt with in the
exactly.
future with what's being contemplated?
Yeah, it's a good question because it shows the promise and also the limits of the so-called revolution in military affairs. First of all, I think the caller is correct to say we probably could not see Saddam doing these things. We hope that we could stop him. We have some limits on what he can import, but we can't really see what's in his basement, and nothing about the RMA is going to change that. I've looked at some of the technologies that are involved in improving sensors. I don't think we're going to be able, even in 20 or 30 years, to figure out exactly what's going on in a basement in Baghdad. So that's a big problem. On the other hand, there are certain things we can see and we'll be able to see better, including missiles. So I'm not so worried that Saddam's going to suddenly create a missile force that we have no idea is coming down the pike. And as for the threats against major American cities, again, that's a place where technology stops and traditional deterrence and traditional strategy begin. I think what you say to Saddam under those circumstances is, no, you won't do that because we are not leaving the Middle East. And believe us, if you do that, we will obliterate your city and your control system at the first sign that you're getting ready to attack us. And that's not going to be something that's changed by technology so much as it is a strategic reality of life that will continue despite all these changes.
The revolution in military affairs, as you all know, is not designed to solve all of the problems facing the United States. And if people threaten to launch nuclear weapons against American cities, I think we have a very good way of responding, which if you nuke us, we'll nuke you. And that's been very effective so far.
When we use this term revolution in military affairs, is it a coherent doctrine or design at this point, or is it more of a series of questions about the future?
It's a series of questions and perhaps an insight. As I said, we're in the early days of it, if it's going to occur at all. The central insight is that we have much more powerful ways of collecting and utilizing information, and that may enable us to conduct warfare in ways in which information plays a role comparable to that which was played by firepower in the past.
This notion you were talking about before about an Air Force without many pilots, is it also possible that we'll have a Navy without aircraft carriers in this vision?
Well, one way of thinking about aircraft carriers in the revolution in military affairs is from the standpoint of information. Aircraft carriers used to survive by being hard to find at night or in bad weather. If you can find a 90,000-ton piece of iron radiating heat and electromagnetic radiation, you can kill it. It used to be possible for the Navy to conceal its carriers by moving them around. If you can't, then you better start thinking about other kinds of ways of operating.
Is a war fought with information less bloody for us?
No, because people, as you pointed out in your introduction, will be thinking about ways in which they can make it bloody for us because they know that's the way to affect American political morale.
So what would be our enemy's resort?
Our enemy's resort would be to do the kinds of things to which Michael and Tom were referring when they discussed the Marines. For example, suppose the bad guys watching us knew that we had this fantastic precision strike capability. What would they do? They would put their forces, as people have begun to done, in the middle of civilian populations. Come get us if you want, but you'll have to kill a lot of civilians. They would begin to think about devious ways of targeting the American civilian population. And people developing what might be called the army in the United States have thought about that. There's one incident, for example, in which a weapon was placed in Serbia next to a hospital. The dare was, you can't destroy that weapon without blowing up the hospital. And what we did was we took a bomb, a precision-guided bomb, took out all the explosives, filled it up with sand, and dropped it exactly on the weapon so that there was no blast damage at all, but we destroyed what we wanted to. It's going to be
is rock, paper, and scissors. Everything creates its own vulnerability. Every new strength has its own weakness. So, for example, if you're going to have space warfare, which I think we will have within a couple of decades, you create enormous vulnerability in your ground stations. And that becomes what the enemy will want to attack. Uh-huh. If you're conducting warfare from space, they'll go after your space control station in Colorado Springs, Colorado.
So the point is to stay a step ahead. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Shalom, thank you for your call. Paul, you are on The Connection.
Yeah, hi, thanks for taking my question. And that is there anybody thinking about what some of the implications might be ethically when the people who are making the decisions about killing other people are removed from the people being killed?
Paul, do you think that perhaps pilots have to face that decision already if they can bomb from 20,000 feet?
Certainly, and also in reference to this sort of idea that we had in both the Gulf and Kosovo wars that we could fight a war with zero casualties.
Let me ask you, since you seem to have done some thinking about this, if you can refine your question, are you saying that there are serious ethical issues with this?
Well, certainly it seems like it might be a little easier to pull the trigger if, you know, you're from a safe distance. But I'm just wondering how that, you know, like in terms of even just more concretely affecting strategy and the way that the war would
Let me
be
ask Stephen Rosen, is there an ethics of war?
There is an ethics of war, and it affects us already. We have moved a long way away from a conscript army to an army of professionals, and the people making the decisions about who to send off to conflict situations are not the people who have children who go into the military, and that's an ethical question which faces us right now. It's not a technologically driven question. I think the ethical question is one of professional ethics. The military has always prized combat leadership. I'm not going to send my men into battle unless I go along with them and I show them that I'm going to bear their costs. That may change in ways which we can't quite foresee now, but right. that will cause a big difference, again, in the culture of the military.
Paul is also asking if there is an ethical issue to be raised when it becomes easier and easier to fight a war by long distance.
I'd like to speak to that.
Go ahead, please.
I think it's already happened.
Yes.
I've heard this referred to, that the new weaponry that we have now has led to what I've heard called a fire-and-forget foreign policy, which is if you can cruise missile Sudan or Afghanistan, you will. We could not have conducted the Kosovo War 15 years ago. No other country could have done it, even now, to go in and have that effect with such precision. You would have had to carpet bomb Belgrade to bring that, and we simply weren't willing to inflict those sort of casualties. But we were willing to use precision weapons to reach that end. So it has become easier to use those things. But it also has raised the question, as one officer said at the end of the Gulf War, end of the Kosovo War, we know what you Americans are willing to kill for, but what are you willing to die for?
It's a very good point. If I could jump in quickly,
sure.
It's Mike O'Hanlon. I think for everything that's every area where you can see change, you can also find areas where there has not been change. If the Kosovo war had intensified and Milosevic had authorized his troops to begin a true genocide against the Kosovar Albanians, or if the war had lingered on much longer, we would have had to probably go in with ground forces to stop that. To go back to Shalom's question, if we want to stop Saddam from developing nuclear weapons, we would probably need to overthrow his government. And you can imagine many scenarios. If Pakistan were to collapse and its nuclear weapons were to be at some risk of being captured by Islamic extremists, we would perhaps need to consider going in with ground forces to help Pakistan restore stability. And all these things, I believe, are going to stay the same. There are going to be constraints on what we can do from 15,000 feet even as technology improves, and I see no fundamental difference between the scenarios I just mentioned today and how they will play out, say, in 2020 or 2030.
Paul, thank you for your call. It opened an interesting area for us. James, you are on The Connection.
Hello, yes.
Hi.
Okay. Actually, I think that my question is probably for Stephen, and the question is as follows. I'm wondering... it kind of made me laugh, first of all, when you said something about if you knew Gus Wilmuth, you... because it made me think about things like Oklahoma City and the World Trade Center bombings and even like, you know, the sarin gas attack in Japan and even to some lesser extent like the Columbine High School shootings. We're having a lot of these sorts of just random acts of violence that happen. And this seems to me to truly typify this kind of asymmetrical attack mode that you spoke of at the beginning of the program. So I'm wondering...
Well, you were just talking about a series of essentially domestic attacks by one's own people. How do you see
right.
this playing into an international scenario? Are you talking about essentially the briefcase bomb and
exactly,
poison gas
exactly
attack
right.
in a subway, that sort of thing?
That's exactly
all
right.
Let's ask Stephen about that. Does this new future envision a defense against, you know, the lone bomber?
Yes, and actually, I'm sorry, I just want to mention very quickly that I believe the World Trade Center bombing was actually by a foreign
absolutely,
power.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Thank you.
No, James, you raised a very interesting question. The question for me is, will governments who want to change the behavior of the United States be able to use these kinds of tactics? If it's a government who wants to change the behavior of the United States, it has to say, I'm the government of Iraq. If you don't change what you do, I'm going to hurt a lot of American citizens.
Let's let
Stephen make this point.
And if it does operate the way I described it, it could be otherwise, then the logic of deterrence does apply, which is to say, government of Iraq, if you kill a lot of American citizens, we'll kill a lot of your people. If it's a terrorist organization, which, as you say, sort of has no obvious purpose, it just wants to hurt people, then you're dealing with a question which is quite difficult. And there, I think the key is this information management. You want much better data on people and things coming into and out of countries.
So that might be the FBI as opposed to the Pentagon, or at least they would have a role in that.
Yes, the American military does not have responsibility for domestic security and surveillance. They're not supposed to do this except in time of war.
Yes, all right. That's all quite well and good. I guess my problem is that ethically, I just don't believe in killing people, period. So I guess that my problem is that I don't really like this concept of, oh, sure, if you bomb us, we're just going to bomb you. I'd rather prevent people from bombing us to start with.
Well, I'd rather, if I had to use force, I would like to use the minimum amount of force and kill the fewest people possible, which is why I think Tom Ricks's point is a very good one. We used to do things by carpet bombing, and that's not a good way to do things. We have better ways of doing this. Human rights organizations, Human Rights Watch, sent Bill Arkin into Kosovo and counted up the number of unintended civilian casualties that were the result of the NATO bombing. And the total number was about 500. Now, you can say 500, it's too many, but it's much smaller than anything like the casualty levels that was experienced in past bombing campaigns.
James, thank you for your call. Mike, you're calling from Buffalo. Hello.
Good morning. I have two questions. The first is, I wonder how much of the new military technology is a response to the United States population aversion to U.S. military casualties. And the second question I have is, I wonder if your guest could talk a little bit about the Street Fighter, a naval craft that's being proposed as an answer to the long-range naval combat of the past.
All right, Mike, I think we touched on your first point. I wanted to see if, Tom Ricks, you feel that you can handle that second one about Street Fighter craft.
I actually think Mike O'Hanlon has written about it, hasn't he, Street Fighter?
Well, I think to some extent.
Thank you.
I'll just briefly say that with Street Fighter, it's the idea of smaller ships that are networked together. You don't put as many eggs in one basket. You don't have a lot of people on any one ship. So if you lose one of those ships, getting to your first question, Mike, then you don't have as great of an effect on American foreign policy and politics. The idea has merit. However, there are also reasons why you have big ships. You have big ships because they can carry a lot more ordnance. You have big ships because they can carry big radars that we need to see what's going on in the battlefield. So perhaps the question is that you divide the labor and you have Street Fighters as the ships that go close to enemy shores where they're more vulnerable to do things like mine warfare or anti-submarine warfare, where they're especially vulnerable and where they don't need a lot of heavy equipment necessarily to do their job. And then you have larger ships a couple hundred miles offshore to carry the big missiles, to carry the radars. That may be the way we should go. Again, I don't think it's an either or. I don't think the RMA concept usually gives us either or choices. It gives us new opportunities, but they're going to often be juxtaposed with existing capability.
Stephen Rosen, when we've been, I guess, focused for nearly 50 years on the notion that the Soviet Union was our enemy, turned into Russia, not so much our enemy, can we know who our enemies will be 20, 30 years from now?
Not with precision everywhere, but there are some things that we can say, in my view at least. The growth in economic and military power of China, the fact that the United States is currently the dominant military power in Asia, in the Western Pacific, and that China wants to be, I think creates some interesting questions. And North Korea and Iraq clearly are still problems.
Connection listeners, the number to call is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University,
I'm John Donvan. This is The Connection, and we are raising the curtain on a whole new theater of war this hour with my guests, Michael O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institution, Stephen Rosen from Harvard, and Tom Ricks from The Washington Post. Connection listeners, what will war look like in 20 years, and what does our military have to do to win that war? Join our conversation by calling 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tom Ricks, we've been talking about perception that change is needed and the debate about how change should be made. There's also the question about how change will be paid for and whether the American public and Congress is ready to support a revolution in the Army. What about Congress? Are they behind what's being talked about?
No, if anything, what's most remarkable about what's going on at the Pentagon now with Rumsfeld's initiative is the lack of support and interest. The U.S. military is not signed on, and the U.S. Congress is not signed on, and the American people generally aren't paying attention to it. And it's very difficult to bring radical change to an institution when there's no outside impetus for it.
What's the source of resistance in Congress?
It's not so much resistance, which actually you could work with, I think, and engage. It's a simple lack of interest. It's apathy. There's not a lot of interest in defense on the Hill. Defense is a loser issue on the Hill. People do not want to serve on the military committees. I ask these guys why, and they say, because when you go back to the district, the only question you're going to get is, hey, smart guy, if you're on the defense committee, why couldn't you keep the base open?
Mm-hmm.
And the bases are being closed. And so people on the Hill generally run from the military issue these days.
What about arms manufacturers? I would assume that shipbuilders who make aircraft carriers probably are less enthusiastic about a future without, let me make it broader, that the arms industry has perhaps a vested interest in the existing set of armaments, or are they willing just to build the new ones and they'll still be in business?
You're exactly right. The way to make money in the defense industry is to make existing weapons, to churn out what you already know how to make. The way to lose money is to do a lot of research and development on a weapon system that could be canceled just as you're ready to start building it. So they like building the conventional stuff they've been building already. They're very worried by this new stuff. The second problem is, as you move to a more information-based defense industry, you knock down the barriers between the traditional benders of metal who make ships, planes, and tanks, and suddenly the Microsofts and the Dell computers of the world suddenly may have the upper hand in building the weaponry of tomorrow.
Well, Rumsfeld's one initiative, which has been less noticed, is in fact to pay military industrial contractors money for their research and development so they can make a profit on that to help get around the barrier, which Tom Ricks pointed out, which is a big change. We tend to talk about Congress, we tend to talk about obstacles, and we tend to talk about what people could do, mostly in terms of money and things we buy, and that's important. But Congress has another very important role. Congress, by law, has to ratify the promotions of officers. It has a role in who are the people who are going to run the military. And there's a congressman from Missouri, Ike Skelton, who has been in the forefront and saying, if you're serious about thinking of the military, pay attention to how you develop your officers. And for me, the big thing that Congress has done in the 1920s and 1930s and could do now is focus on what kind of officers do we want to have 20 years from now.
What is your answer to that question?
I think we need officers who, first of all, are comfortable with the information technologies, who are more exposed to it, and I think we'll get that. I think we need officers who are more comfortable with much more decentralized and flatter military organizations than we have now. Michael O'Hanley pointed out that relative to other countries, we are already much more decentralized, but I think we may have to go even further. So I think that we have to think about not only buying the right kinds of weapons, but getting the kinds of people who would think the new kinds of ways, because that really is the key at the end.
Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Marie, you're on the connection from Washington, Iowa.
Yes. With the development of this so-called new technology and new warfare, other nations eventually will develop the same thing. And at this point in time, we need to get support from the populace for this. For when that happens, when other nations develop the ability to conduct warfare by remote control, so to speak, no place in the United States will be immune from attack. And are the American population willing or ready or of the maybe psychological nature or strength of character to accept that possibility? And as a nation, can we withstand it? Not just militarily, but emotionally.
What do you mean by that, emotionally?
How we've never had a war since the Civil War.
Do you recall living through the Soviet nuclear threat? We had that for a long time hanging over our heads.
That was a threat.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point in time, I don't think anyone took it seriously.
Well, let me turn this to...
In the population. Let's say in the heartland, perhaps did not take it seriously because they didn't think they could be reached. But with new technology, that is a possibility.
It's a good point, and I want to turn it to Stephen. And I think what Marie is really saying is, once the other guys figure out what to do, are we going to be in an even more vulnerable world than we're in now?
Well, as Tom Ricks said, this is military and strategic interaction is rock, paper, scissors, and it's already going on. The Chinese have developed long-range ballistic missiles. They are already developing the capability of striking at people at longer distances. I think people in the heartland of America do worry about this, and I think that's why public opinion polls always show that most people in the United States are interested in things like national missile defense, because it protects them. It's not something abstract. It's not about protecting obscure national interests. It's about protecting them directly, and that's why I think national missile defense is worth taking seriously. The idea, I think, behind Marie's question is, if we did not engage in this development of new technology, maybe other people wouldn't either.
Yeah.
And that's something which I would want to think hard about. I think the reason why people in other countries are developing new kinds of military technology is because we often want to tell them how they should live. After all, we do go into other people's countries and say, you know, all this ethnic cleansing that you're doing, we don't want you to do it. Mm. I think the question, therefore, is not really about technology. It's about the nature of American political objectives abroad.
What do you think of that, Marie?
Well, you're close.
That's pretty good for me.
I don't think there's any doubt but what other nations will have, if not already have, this technology. But as the American, well, psyche, if you will, ready to accept the fact that we are no longer invincible and vulnerable, that we can have...
It's interesting.
In our backyard.
I wonder if that very issue ever comes up in wargaming or not. Marie, thank you very much for your call. John, you are calling from Charlottesville, Virginia. Welcome to The Connection.
Thank you. Good morning. Appreciate the excellent program this morning. My question is two-part. Number one, in light of the new developing technology and where it might take us, I'm wondering if it's also necessary that the existing body of customary international law and the Geneva Conventions that govern the law of armed conflict will have to evolve, number one. And if it does have to evolve and other nations aren't developing similar technologies or on board with what we're doing, how do we get the consensus necessary to get that body of law
very,
to evolve?
Very interesting question. Michael O'Hanlon, have you thought about that?
Well, I would say that they are good questions, John, but I would say that in a sense we already are doing much of what the Geneva Conventions would require, partly because we want to respect them, partly because, as we've been discussing today, low casualty wars are more conducive to American political support. We certainly like to have lower casualties for our own soldiers. You saw in the Kosovo campaign the precision with which we struck. But there's no way, in my judgment, that certain kinds of enemies will agree to those same rules because they recognize, again, as we've been mentioning today, that our greatest vulnerability is perhaps our aversion to casualties. And the Osama bin Ladens of the world are simply not going to play by those rules. Now, you could say, well, that's just a certain category of rogue threat, but it may be the most important kind. So we can try to construct such rules, but in the end, we're going to have to be willing, in my judgment, in certain extreme cases, to fight terrorism directly and not just expect people to play by the standards that we've established among the industrial democracies and other major powers.
Terrorists do not sign treaties. John, thank
that
you.
That perhaps is our great concern.
John, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Bruce, welcome to The Connection.
Hi.
Hi, Bruce.
Thanks for this show. I really appreciate something about the military once in a while. I don't think we talk about it enough in the civilian world.
Are you in the military yourself?
I was in the Air Force 24 years, and I was a maintainer, aircraft maintainer. And my question really has to do with how are we going to, or are there systems in place to assure that we will have, you know, these new things that are coming online are going to be actually functional. I used to work on a lot of aircraft that, you know, some of the systems, some of the features just actually never worked. Even I worked on F-4Ds, which came out in the 60s, and 15 years later, some of those, some of that functionality we're supposed to have,
but
still didn't work.
Are you just asking a basic maintenance question, or
question? I'm asking basically, you know, in a lot of ways.
They're too sophisticated?
Basically, coming back to the missile defense system, you know, there's a lot of visibility on that system to make sure that it works before we actually deploy it. And I'm wondering if these other systems are going to have that much visibility to make sure that they actually work before we put it out in the field and people find out, well, gee, that's kind of critical, but it doesn't really work that well.
It's a good point, but the people tend to assume that new technology is more complex, more complex technology fails more often. And a lot of times that's true. My personal computer goes down a lot. But sometimes new technology, in fact, is more reliable. Cars are more reliable now than they used to be because the technology that goes into them is superior. Vacuum tube technology is not as reliable as microchip technology. And I think we ought to be focusing on your question. When we buy new technologies, not only the ones that work best, but the ones which are most sustainable and maintainable.
Actually, Bruce, if you came back to the Air Force today, I think you'd be pleasantly surprised at the emphasis on exactly what you're talking about, on maintainability. Aircraft today, for example, are built in a way they weren't when you were working on the F-4 to make the needed areas immediately accessible so you don't have to do things like take off the wing to get to the right engine part. I was talking to a Navy mechanic recently on an aircraft carrier, and I said, what do you think of the F-18? He said, I hate it. And I said, why? He said, it's so boring. It takes 15 minutes. You just slap open the panel, slap on a new computer chip, and slap it closed, and it flies away.
Bruce, well, any chance we're going to get you back into the Air Force?
There's not much chance of that happening. But I did work on the F-16, and I found the same thing. You could really work on it easily, but a lot of that had to do with the fact that you were just a box swapper. You know, instead of actually doing repairs on the aircraft, the computer would say, okay, well, this is probably what's wrong. You pull the unit out, send it to the shop, get a new one out of supply, and plug that one in. The problem is a lot of times the testers and the actual functionality on the aircraft weren't aligned, so the test station would say, yeah, it's fine.
All right, Bruce. Well, it sounds like I hope you're enjoying your retirement, because it sounds like it wore you down after a while. I'd like to – we have a situation now where with the president in Europe, he's once again telling the Russians that he is determined to build this anti-missile defense system. I'd like to ask all of you as we head into the end of the program, is that part of RMA? And if the president is determined on this, is the rest of RMA going to follow? Stephen?
Missile defense is very old. We were working on it in the 1950s. I worked on it in the 1970s and 1980s. People tend to assume revolutionary military affairs and missile defense are the same. I think they're distinguishable. As for Russia and the United States, I think the basic insight of the Bush administration is that a lot of people are going to face missile threats, not just the United States, and we may have some shared interest in developing common missile defenses.
Thomas Ricks, very briefly, where do you see this revolution going, and how quickly do you see it moving?
I think it's going to be a wave we're going to ride for decades as the information age settles into the U.S. military.
And Michael O'Hanlon, do you think at any point Congress will get interested enough to follow along?
Yeah, Congress will get interested, but I think the big question on the RMA is it going to just make us better at things we're already good at? Mm-hmm. And is it really going to solve the kinds of problems and help us in the kinds of conflicts that are the most difficult and challenging? And we have to go along with innovation, but it may help us more with things we're already good at than things we need to get better at.
All right. I would like to thank Bruce for his call, and I would like to thank our guests this hour. Thomas Ricks is military correspondent for The Washington Post. Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. And Stephen Rosen is the director of the Olin Institute for Strategic Studies at Harvard. Connection listeners, you can continue the revolutionary military affairs conversation in our online forum at theconnection.org. I'm John Donvan. This is The Connection.
This is WB.